So we looked at self-development last week, and we sort of saw, well, lots of people would say it's the most characteristically Buddhist approach. I think some people would say it's the Buddhist approach, self-development. You work on yourself. It uses the Buddhist idea of karma and the Buddhist idea of conditionality. You use the conditions and you gradually change yourself by changing your conditions, doing practices. It's commonsensical. It makes sense. It's rational. And it's indispensable. If we don't do some of it, if we don't actually work on ourselves in certain ways, get out of bed to meditate, make a decision to follow precepts, etc. If we don't do some of that, then we're not going to get anywhere. We need to make a bit of an effort. So it's very Buddhist. It's commonsensical. It uses Buddhist ideas. Lots of people would say, I think, well, that's the one. That's the one. But I think we also saw last week and the week before that really none of these models is right or wrong. We need a bit of all of them. They've all got plus sides and negative sides. You certainly need some of this self-development model. But in contrast, the idea of self-development, which lots of people would say, well, that's it, that's the Buddhist one. Lots of people, the idea of self-surrender, I think, you know, some people would say, well, it doesn't seem very Buddhist. It doesn't seem very Buddhist, this idea of self-surrender. It seems much more typical of something like Christianity or something. You give yourself up to something. So in the West, I think a lot of Western Buddhists might say, well, it's not very Buddhist. But funnily enough, if you went to the East, of course, you'd find that's maybe even the prevailing model. It's maybe the way that most people do it. But not in the West. We tend to have really got hold of this idea of self-development. So given that for an awful lot of Western Buddhists, we've really got hold of this idea of self-development, we think that's the really defining feature of Buddhism, that we work on ourselves. What is this idea of self-surrender doing in Buddhism? How did it get there? I mean, you've got the Buddha saying, with mindfulness, strive on! Be ye islands unto yourselves, etc., etc. How did this idea of self-surrender get in there? How did it develop? And what use is it? Why would we wish to consider it at all? So to explain those three things, I think, what's it doing in Buddhism? How did it get, what use is it, and how did it get there? How did it develop? I think we have to go back in time. I think I have to take us back in time. 2,500 years, reel it back. 2,500 years to the time of the Buddha. And at the time of the Buddha and ever since, I think the key to it, I'm going to use this word discipleship, if you like. At the time of the Buddha and ever since, in Buddhism, there's been a strong tradition of the, if you like, the teacher-disciple relationship in Buddhism. It might be with the Buddha or it might be with another teacher, but a strong tradition where the disciple, the student, lives with or spends a lot of time with somebody who he accepts is further along the path than himself, him or herself. So live with a teacher, accept the practices the teacher teaches, took advice and followed the directions given by the teacher, developed a relationship with the teacher, emulated the teacher, took the teacher as an example. So in a sense, gave oneself, surrendered in a sense to the teacher. That's always been a strong tradition in Buddhism, this sense of recognizing that somebody else is actually further along than yourself and taking them very seriously, taking what they say very seriously, even emulating them, taking them as an example. And then when you do that, when we sort of give ourselves to the teacher, to accept this sort of position of discipleship, over time, what's likely to happen is that we absorb some of the teacher's positive qualities. Assuming that the teacher is further developed than ourselves, the disciple develops by absorbing the positive qualities of the teacher. develops, refines their habits of action and speech to be more like that of the person they're emulating, develops similar mental states through doing the same sort of practices, comes to see the world through the same sort of eyes, through similar eyes. So that's always been there in a way. And if so if this is us, and this is the teacher, we sort of do it that way. We give ourselves, in a sense, to the teacher. And if the teacher was the Buddha, and lots of people were lucky enough to have the Buddha then as a teacher, then we move from where we are to enlightenment by giving ourselves to the Buddha, or people did that. Giving ourselves to the teacher. So we accept the teacher as further on than us, and that if I want to go, I want to go further, so I will do what the teacher advises rather than what I want, rather than what my little ego wants. And that practice goes right back to the Buddha. So self-surrender in this sense has always been a big part of Buddhism, right back to the time of the Buddha. Yes, we develop ourselves. We do practices to develop ourselves, but we do that in the context of discipleship, or people did that in the context of discipleship, in the context of respect, even devotion, to someone further along, even obedience to someone further along, even surrender to someone further along. So there was a big element of self-surrender in the way people practiced. And that goes back to the Buddha, but it's still very much alive. I mean, I'll just give you a few examples of how that might work. So Sangharakshita talks about this, the founder of the Western Buddhist Order. He talks about this when he was studying under one of his teachers, his first teacher, Jagdish Kashyap. And he said he realized, well, actually, it's pretty difficult to just stop doing what your ego wants. You know, you can be practicing, you're putting yourself, you know, you're studying, but basically you're still doing what you want. You're still following the ego. You still basically think, I'd rather do that than that, I'll do that. You're still basically following your likes and dislikes. And he thought, this is incredibly difficult for me to stop just following my likes and dislikes, following my conditioned views. How am I going to get out of it? And he thought, well, I'll do a very traditional thing. I'll say to Jagdish Kashyap, my teacher, I don't want to make, you know, you just tell me what to do. I am going to put myself completely in your hands. I'm going to surrender to you. You just tell me what to do. And if I just do what you say, then, well, I mean, my ego doesn't come into it. I accept that you're further along than me. I'll do what you say. So he did that. He said to Jagdish Kashyap, yeah, you know, just tell me what to do. I'll do it. I have a suspicion that Jagdish Kashyap thought, oh, my God, what am I going to do with this guy? But he did that. He did that. And he said, well, yes, it did really help. It helped to overcome his ego. Just saying, well, I'm not going to do what my ego wants. I'm going to do what someone who I accept is a bit further along than me wants. Someone who's my teacher wants. And in the end, as a way of giving, as the only way of overcoming the ego. And in the end, Jagdish Kashyap said to him, when they were in Kalimpong, he said, stay here and work for the Dharma. And he did. He stayed there and worked for the Dharma. And out of that, the FWBO comes. So maybe we should be really grateful for that, the fact that he just stayed there and worked for the Dharma, doing what his teacher said. And that sort of has carried on, because I know somebody, my personal preceptor did the same with Sangharakshita. He said, well, I'll just do what you want. You tell me what to do and I will do it. And I know somebody else who said it to him subsequently, said, I want to work for you and I want you to just tell me what to do, because I want to get away from just always going on my little silly likes and dislikes. I just do what you say. Although I have to say that in that latter case, he did renegotiate after a while. Because he might have found it a little bit challenging what was said. So self-surrender with renegotiation. Scope 4. So it goes right back to the Buddha, and it goes right up, that sort of style of discipleship, if you like, goes right back to the Buddha, and it goes right up to the present day. But there's a problem with that, isn't there? Because very few people, and it'd be great, wouldn't it, to be in a discipleship relationship with the Buddha. That must have been just completely revolutionary, revolutionizing. But very few people can be in that sort of relationship with an enlightened being. There aren't that many to go around, and they can't have that many personal disciples at that level. So even during the Buddha's life, most of his disciples weren't living with him. Right? And even during the Buddha's life, meditation practices developed that helped people get some of that effect, some of that sort of discipleship effect, even if they didn't live with the Buddha. So an example of that is in the story of a guy called Pingya, and his story is in the Sutta Nipata, which is reckoned to be part of it, some of the old, very oldest Buddhist scriptures. And this guy Pingya, he's getting on a bit, I sympathize. He's with this guy that used to be his teacher, and he's waxing lyrical about the Buddha. He is really waxing lyrical about the Buddha. He says, he is a mammoth of knowledge, enlightened, awake, with total vision. Dissolving the darkness, this beam of light, this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, whose words are full of beauty. He is the way to the beyond, whose Dharma is the way things really are, with nothing else quite like it in the world. This is the man I follow. And you have to remember, he's saying this to his previous teacher, who says, oh yeah, Pingya. Yeah, yeah. So, if he's so great, why are you here? Why aren't you with him? If he is this universe of understanding, why aren't you with him? Why don't you go with him? Why aren't you where he is? And Pingya says, oh, well, I'm old. I'm old and I can't do it. I just can't. This guy walks around all over the place. He lives in the woods. He's terrible. You know, he's really difficult to keep up with. I can't do it. I'm old. My body is frail. I can't be with him. But, he says, there is no moment for me, however small, that is spent away from the Buddha. He says, by mindfulness and meditation, it's possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, by day and night. And since I spend my nights meditating on him and revering him, there is not a single moment I spend away from him. And because of this, my mind is constantly full of faith and joy, he says. Because I'm constantly meditating on the Buddha, constantly bearing in mind, my mind is constantly full of faith and joy, and constantly governed by the Dharma, and constantly governed by the enlightened awareness of the Buddha. So that's where he gets by meditating on the Buddha, bearing the Buddha in mind. And at the end of the sutra passage, the Buddha appears and says, other people too have liberated themselves by this practice. Other people too have liberated themselves by the power of faith. You should let the power of faith release you, Pingya, take you to the other shore, and take you beyond the grip of death, the reach of death. And Pingya replies, you may consider this as mind released. And everybody goes, yes! So even during the Buddha's lifetime, imaginatively putting yourself in the presence of the Buddha, surrendering in a sense to the Buddha as a higher being, was a common and recognized meditation practice. And then after the death of the Buddha, it became even more important. It became a very important practice indeed. Some say the most important meditation practice in most schools of Buddhism was what's called mindfulness of the Buddha, bearing the Buddha and his qualities in mind. So mindfulness of the Buddha meditation became the most important type of meditation practice. And there's lists and lists given of the traditional benefits of that practice. So it's said that if you keep the Buddha in mind, meditate on the Buddha, you attain the fullness of faith, mindfulness and wisdom, that it overcomes fear and anxiety, that the practitioner comes to feel as though they were living in the master's presence, His or her mind tends towards the plane of the Buddhas, and he becomes as worthy of veneration as a shrine room. So we're also told, if tempted by unskillfulness, he would no more give in than if he was sitting in front of the Buddha. And that the practitioner will definitely progress to a higher destiny. So there's a lot of very positive things said about this sort of practice. So I think the key to it, there's two phrases there. It's as though living in the Buddha's presence. If you do that practice, it's as though you live in the Buddha's presence. And if you do that practice, your mind tends towards the plane of the Buddhas. So if you do that practice, it's as though you were living in the Buddha's presence. It's as though you did have the Buddha as a personal teacher. It has that effect on you. And because of that, your mind tends towards the plane of the Buddha, or of the Buddhas. So that's a clue to how it works. So William James, I think it is, the sort of American writer on religious topics, said, what we put our attention on, that we become. So if we put our attention on the qualities of enlightenment, we become more enlightened. If we put our attention on the higher qualities, we put our attention on a higher being, our mind will come to inhabit the higher plane. We will come to inhabit the higher plane, the plane of the Buddhas. We'll move from A to B. And not by consciously sort of seeking to develop the qualities of B, but almost by letting B take us over, giving ourselves to B, giving ourselves to an enlightened being in meditation. As the same way we might give ourselves to the Buddha as an enlightened teacher and say, just, you know, tell me what to do. So this was a really highly important practice, and still is, mindfulness of the Buddha. And as Buddhism developed, of course, it got more and more rich because we sort of discovered all these other archetypal figures. You've got different Buddhas appearing who represented, if you like, different facets of enlightenment. You got Bodhisattva figures like Tara and Avalokiteshvara, embodying, personifying compassion, or Manjushri personifying wisdom, or Vajrapani personifying energy, or Vajrasattva personifying our innate purity of being. And then you get the development of meditation practices based around all those figures, bearing in mind, letting our attention dwell on any one of those figures, until you get the sort of tantric visualization practices where you clearly sort of visualize and use a mantra to contact a particular sort of energy, if you like. And that sort of thing goes on to today. I mean, most members of the Western Buddhist Order, when they get ordained, they're given a visualization practice relating to one of these figures with a mantra. And most order members will every day do a visualization practice with a mantra, which is about one of these figures, and is really an extension of this practice of bearing the Buddha in mind. It's bearing a higher being in mind, letting our attention dwell on a higher being, connecting with a higher being. So you imaginatively put yourself in the presence of a higher being, and you absorb the qualities of that being, so that the mind tends to a higher plane, if you like. So that's still very, very important practice. And if you really want to get anything from those practices, it sort of involves a shift in our centre of gravity. If you really, I mean, you can do that sort of practice as a sort of nice visualisation, nice imaginative exercise. But if we really want to get something from it, it involves a bit of a shift in our centre of being, centre of gravity. It involves a bit of a shift in the basis on which we take our decisions, from taking our decisions on the basis of the likes and dislikes and views of the limited little me, to seeing ourselves, if you like, taking decisions on the basis of an aspect, as ourselves as an aspect of a higher being, or somebody who's at least in contact with a higher being. So it involves a definite element of giving up my little likes and dislikes and being guided by that higher plane of being that we can get tend towards by doing this sort of practice. So it involves an element of self-surrender. So you get an example of that, for example, with Sangharakshita again. When he was living in Kalimpong, and facing an awful lot of terrific difficulties. I mean, he had terrific adversities that he was sort of dealing with, being this almost lone Buddhist up there for a long time. And he was, it was just a very difficult situation for a lot of time. And he was doing, one of the things he'd taken on was the Tara practice, the practice of Tara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, female Bodhisattva of compassion. And he decided, one of the things he talks about is moving, as it were, from making decisions on the basis of what he thought, to asking Tara what she thought, making decisions more on the basis of, well, what does Tara think about this? And he describes this as incredibly powerful, a sort of shift away from being governed by the personal towards being governed by the transcendental. So he describes that as an incredibly powerful experience. So these practices can be very powerful. They are very powerful. You can't judge them without actually doing them. I think that's one of the things to say about them. They might sound a bit strange or even silly, but many people experience them as terrifically powerful. I should say also they're not something you want to do prematurely. You could cheapen them for yourselves or spoil them by sort of doing them without the right context, without protective context around them. But certainly done as something that you take up with the support, strong support of a teacher and in the context of a serious commitment, they're very, very powerful. Now, I can almost hear some people thinking, eek! This is, the idea of giving yourself up to some being. Doesn't sound surrendering to even a teacher or to some other being. It all sounds a bit, well, fair enough. I mean, it's an approach to the Dharma. Luckily, one of the things about the Dharma is you don't all have to do it the same way. Yippee! But having said that, I mean, something that's often said about this is, yes, but what do we surrender to now? Very often what we surrender to is greed, hate, delusion, our conditioning, etc. Maybe it's a distinct improvement to surrender to a teacher that we take as more enlightened than ourselves, or to a being that somehow gives us a bit of access to a higher plane of being. And actually, it's easy enough to give a sort of rational psychological explanation of why these practices work and how they work. Practices like bearing the Buddha in mind, meditating on the Buddha, visualizing these various figures, using mantras. So, I mean, the sort of classic psychological explanation that's given is that what we do when we do this is we project spiritual qualities that are in ourselves, but that we're not normally in touch with. We're just not normally in touch with them. They're deep in us, but we don't have access to them. What we do is by imagining an idealized being or a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, by imagining an idealized being, we project these qualities that we're not in touch with in ourselves outside us onto another being. And then by focusing on that being, dwelling on that being, contemplating the qualities of that being, we sort of absorb them back into ourselves, but at a conscious level, we become conscious of them. So what we're doing is taking something that's hidden in us, projecting it out there, and then reintegrating it, if you like, as on a conscious level. That's the way it's sort of often put. We reabsorb those qualities. And seen like that, these practices would really be an aspect of self-realization rather than self-surrender. They'd be about finding things in us. And lots of people choose to see them like that, which is fine, because, great, you can see it whichever way you like. So lots of people choose to see it that way, and that makes perfect rational sense. You don't have to disturb your rationalism at all to do that sort of practice that way. But... Many people who do these practices, and lots of people do those practices, many people who do these practices don't see it like that at all. And they don't see it like that at all, not because of any sort of intellectualization or rationalization. They don't see it like that at all, simply because it's not their experience. It's not my experience, and I think there's a lot of other people would say, it's not their experience that what we're doing is just sort of doing some sort of psychological trick with ourselves where we sort of get something out and get it back again. It really seems for many people as though the actual experience is of encountering something higher and deeper and wiser than ourselves. Can't defend that. It's just a lot of people's experience, including mine. That we're actually putting ourselves in touch with a real energy out there in the universe. Something that really exists that we can relate to as we might relate to a teacher, a being who takes an interest in us and wants to help us develop. And if you think that's a load of rubbish, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. You're completely at liberty to do so. And there's loads of other ways you can practice. Everybody doesn't have to do it the same way. But I bet there are plenty of people here who have got at least a taste of that just from some things, simple things like chanting mantras. That our experience when we chant a mantra is not just that it's not just a concentration exercise. It's not just a concentration exercise. The different mantras seem to carry very different experiences with them that bring different flavours. We seem to connect with different energies when we chant different mantras. They have power. They have energy. They're not just something we do, a bit like following the breath. They seem to put us in touch with something. I bet lots of people have that experience, which is maybe something you can talk about later. They really do seem to summon something up. So maybe if you think that's rubbish, fair enough again. But you might want to just suspend disbelief for the duration of this talk, which is very short now. If we can relate to practice in that way, then it becomes enormously powerful. That's one of the things I would say. And it solves some of the problems of the self-development approach. We still need the self-development approach, yeah, but it sort of rounds it out. It sort of completes it. We particularly still need the spirit self-development approach for the first N years of our practice. I think quite a lot of years of our practice. We need to work on ourselves. But this approach can round it out. Why? How? For a start, self-development, I said last week there's a couple of problems with self-development model. One is that it might work really well. So we might, we sort of build ourselves up, we become this incredible spiritual being in our own eyes. We become sort of like a spiritual self-made man. I have done it. I did it my way. And it can lead to sort of spiritual arrogance, if you like, where what we seem to be doing is building up our ego. We become sort of supermen, ubermenches, and we look down on mere people who can't do it that way. So there's a danger of that. There is a danger of that, that it subtly or not so subtly, there's a sort of spiritual arrogance, a sort of inflation of the ego. If we're really successful, we get a bigger ego instead of, as it were, transcending our ego. And the same could be true of the self-realization model. You know, I'm a Buddha. I'm already a Buddha. You know, that can do something for our ego as well. But the self-surrender model completely gets ego out of the way. It completely gets ego out of the way. Because it's not about me. It's not about my development, my meditation, my mental states. It's about serving the universe by aligning myself with something larger and wiser than my little self, acting as a sort of part of something larger. So it gets me out of the way. So it completely counteracts that sort of possibility of sort of spiritual arrogance. The other possible problem with the self-development model is that it can lead to a sort of sense of failure. And I think this can happen when sometimes when people have tried to use it for a very long time. You start out and you make big strides, you know, you make very big strides, and you change and you see your life changing, and it's wonderful. But after a bit, you might reach a bit of a plateau where it's getting a lot more difficult now, and the things you're tackling seem to be a bit more ingrained, and they don't seem to be so susceptible to this sort of approach. And you might seem to come across things that you just can't seem to get anywhere with. And then you start thinking, well, I can't do this. And then you start beating yourself up, making vows, I'm going to change that. And then next week it doesn't change. So then you can really happen with the self-development model. But with the self-surrender model, in a sense, it doesn't matter. Because it's not about me, is it? It sort of goes round the problem. It sort of jinxes round the problem, really. I mean, you can end up doing things like saying, well, if there's something about me that I can't change, well, maybe I'll use it in a positive way. I'll use it to serve whatever it is I serve, my teacher, the Dharma, the enlightened mind. Somebody once said this of me, actually, I have to say this. Somebody once said it of me, well, Vedanya, some people might think you're a bit arrogant. But, well, on the other hand, you've got a sort of self-confidence which makes you quite a good Dharma teacher. You use it. So there you go. You can take that as you like. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I know somebody else, for example, who said to Sangharachita, well, I don't think I can follow this path because actually I'm really ambitious and I don't think I'm going to be able to get around my ambition. I think whatever I do, I'm going to be really ambitious. And he said, use your ambition to serve the Dharma. And he started a business which made millions of quid, millions of money for the Dharma and employs lots of people. And, you know, some people here work for it, I think, or have done. So, you know, you don't make it a problem because it's not about you. It's not about you. And somehow taking that approach, not trying to sort of make a head-on assault on some of our temperamental qualities, if you like, not trying to make a head-on assault on them, can somehow change them anyway. It's as though putting ourselves at the service of something higher than ourselves sort of can dissolve them away, can sort of reduce their, make them less important, make them less of a problem by taking the focus off me and my issues and putting the focus on something higher than me, a higher plane. So it can, for those reasons, it can round out, if you like, it can round out the self-development model. Got to say, we need the self-development model. We need it when we first start, and we need it for many, many years. It's got to be the main model we follow. We've got to work on ourselves with a certain amount of effort. But it does need to be rounded out, and especially perhaps when we've been practicing for a while. And it can open the door, this other model can open the door to a different way of seeing Buddhist practice, where, and it's a way that has a very powerful effect on a lot of people, especially when they've been practicing for a while, actually, especially when people have been practicing self-development for a while. This can have a really positive effect, where we start seeing practice not so much about developing myself, so much as about getting myself out of the way, so that something else can manifest through me. Something bigger and wiser can manifest through us. And that can bring a real sense of liberation and release. So Sangharachita talks about this in terms of what he called, in terms of a traditional Buddhist term, the bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, literally, bodhi means wisdom or enlightenment. Citta means mind or something like mind. Or will. Could translate it as spirit of enlightenment, the bodhicitta as the spirit of enlightenment. And Sangharachita talks about it as something transpersonal, something beyond any individual that we can tap into, a force in the universe, a will in the universe that's trying to move consciousness forward, trying to create a more enlightened consciousness, more enlightened beings. And he talks about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, etc., as the Bodhisattvas' archetypal figures, that they really are. They're sort of the way the bodhicitta manifests to us, appears to us. And he talks about a style of practice where we can become part of the bodhicitta by opening ourselves up to it. We open ourselves up to it, we create the conditions for it to manifest through us without losing our individuality. So not losing our individuality, but aligning ourselves with something larger. And if we do this, the bodhicitta can arise within us. We enter into a sort of community of beings where we move to a higher sort of shared level of consciousness without sacrificing individuality. We become part of the bodhisattva. There's only one bodhisattva, we become part of it. Part of the enlightened mind, part of big mind. We allow big mind to act through us. We allow the spirit of enlightenment to act through us. And that could be symbolized by, as a symbol, the figure of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of compassion and shown in various different ways. But one way he's shown is with a thousand arms. And these thousand arms are each holding different things. They're each holding, they could be holding books, they could be holding cooking spoons, they could be holding all sorts of things. They could be holding malas. What do they hold? They could be holding
bows and arrows.
They could be holding all sorts of things. So a thousand arms. And these arms, if you like, are the ways that the bodhicitta, that the Avalokiteshvara, helps beings. They're gifts, they're offerings, they're tools by which the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara helps beings, gives beings what they need to develop. And we can become one of those arms by aligning ourselves with something beyond ourselves. We can become one of those arms. We don't lose our individuality. We become our real selves in doing that. So each of those arms is an individual, if you like, but they're also part of a higher being, Avalokiteshvara. They're all aligned with a single higher purpose, if you like. The purpose of Avalokiteshvara, the purpose of the bodhicitta, the purpose of the spirit of enlightenment. And this is an image or approach to the spiritual life that very much expresses, if you like, the model of self-surrender. And if it appeals to you, you might want to dwell on it a little, that sort of image. You might want to bring that image in a little bit if it appeals to you. If it doesn't appeal to you, never mind. We've all got plenty of good, honest work to do, good, honest self-development work to do, even if we don't want to be an arm of thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. But if you do, you might just want to take that image away of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara as a sort of fruits of an approach that's more to do with self-surrender. So that's a little bit about the self-surrender model.